Today I'm speaking to Professor Stephen Broadbury, Research Team Leader for CAGE and one of the authors of the report. Professor Broadbury's chapter focuses on the BRICS. I asked him to tell us more about what economic history teaches us about the growth prospects of these countries. So Professor Broadbury, your chapter focuses on the BRICS and what economic history says about their growth prospects. Could you tell us a little bit more about this?
Well, I think the primary focus of this chapter starts from the proposition that a lot of economic analysis of growth is based on looking at very recent trends. But the issues of how competitive advantage shifts between nations is usually played out over very long periods of time, and so we need to take a longer historical perspective. When we do that, the first thing we discover is that changes of economic leadership have actually been very rare. In the last 1,000 years or so, we can think of only five countries really being the leading economies: China, Italy, the Dutch Republic, Britain, and the United States. So we don't expect to see dramatic changes in economic leadership happening very often. Now, one reason for that is simply that the technology which underpins high productivity and economic leadership is often suited to particular circumstances in a particular country, to do with factor prices, different resource endowments, and so on. So it's not easy to immediately transfer those to other countries without adapting them to the local circumstances. And furthermore, that effect is reinforced by what we might call institutional factors, which is that an economy in a country has a set of interlocking elements, sets of incentives for people to face, and they all fit together. And it's not easy to simply take one aspect of a society's structure, institutional framework, and impose it on another country. You have to take the whole package together. So what we're seeing with the BRIC countries, that's Brazil, Russia, India and China, is, yes, they've been growing rapidly, and they are big economies. They're big economies, though, because they have a lot of people. So it's not that they are getting anywhere close to challenging the leading Western countries in terms of income per head. It's that because they have a lot of people, the total income in the economy is getting large. So we shouldn't make the mistake of working from seeing them becoming big in terms of GDP, to thinking that they're challenging economic leadership in terms of per capita income. And that helps us to put them into this longer run perspective. Through history, we see lots of economies that start on the path of catching up in per capita incomes, but then they stall in that process a long way before they reach the frontier. And one thing that is quite interesting here is that you can see a distinction between policies that help to get a country started on the process of catching up and policies which help to sustain that catching up and stop growth slowdowns, the process stalling. Now, we have to be a little bit careful here because there's a bit of a tension between explaining the particular historical context and drawing out general conclusions, but people always want the general conclusions, so let me move in that direction and say that one generalisation we might come to is that, and this is what makes the catching up process so difficult, is that encouraging the institutions which get you started on the process of catching up, those same institutions can then actually hinder the completion of the process. Let me give an example for that. If in the catching up process you realise what you need to do is to develop modern industry, you arrange your society's institutions so that people are very good at industrial production. And that's very good in the early stages, but in the later stages, economies tend to become dominated by services. And the same kind of institutional structures that help you to provide industry very efficiently may hinder you in providing efficient services. So, one of the lessons is that the institutions have to be flexible enough to cope with changing circumstances. At the same time, though, they need to be stable enough to provide incentives for people taking long-term decisions. If you're expecting people to invest in projects which will take 20 to 30 years to pay off, you can't keep changing the policies so that the payoffs vary. So there's an inevitable tension here between getting the policies right to encourage the process getting started, but being flexible enough to enable it to continue. I think perhaps it's helpful to look at the individual BRIC countries one by one, just to sort of illustrate the conclusions we can draw from this historical perspective. First one I'd like to consider is Russia, because that's actually the richest BRIC country. Its per capita income level, though, and this sometimes shocks people, today is about 30% of the level of the United States. So yes, it's on the catching up path, but it's got an awfully long way to go. Interestingly, Russia has been on this catch-up path before, during the Soviet era. In 1917, it was an extremely poor country, and following the Soviet Revolution, it got onto a catch-up path, but stalled very badly before it got anywhere near the frontier. Now, this time round, we can see, yes, here's a second go at getting on the catch-up path. It is now taking place within the context of a market economy, but nevertheless, it still has an authoritarian government, which provides really only quite selective enforcement of property rights. The current growth has also actually been quite highly dependent on oil, and we see lots of examples of growth booms based on natural resources, which don't sustain long-term development. So I think if catching up is to continue in Russia, we need reforms to ensure more transparent rule of law, a better institutional framework which will help to complete the catching up process. Second country I'd like to consider is China. China's at about 20% of the US level. Despite its fantastic growth at 10% a year for several decades, three decades or more, that tells you how far it had to go, how poor it was when it started on the catching up path. It is, nevertheless, a remarkable achievement when you compare it with attempts to reform other socialist economies. China, of course, was a communist regime which has introduced market reforms. It fairly quickly, in the Russian case, the Soviet case, led to disaster. That hasn't happened in the Chinese case. And the way we can understand that is that the Chinese system is what we might call decentralized, regionally decentralized authoritarianism. And what happened here is that there's been competition between provincial leaders. So within a particular province, a leader takes responsibility for coordinating reforms, providing public services, enforcing the law within their own jurisdiction. It's a kind of competitive process. Each leader is trying to get on with the central government. And that has provided selective enforcement of property rights and enabled the development process to continue. The thing that I would point out here is that that sort of authoritarian regime is fine when you're starting out a long way behind the frontier. You know what you want to achieve, and you get a strong man who achieves it. It becomes harder to sustain as you get nearer the frontier. The objectives multiply, the private sector becomes more important, pressures for democracy grow. It's not so clear what you need to do. In fact, when you get to the point of the frontier, you have to innovate, and there's no clear goal. At that point, then, an authoritarian regime faces problems. So I think we still need to see reforms in the institutional framework in China. Brazil is also at around about 20% of the US level in terms of per capita income. Brazil, like Russia, has seen a previous case of stalled catching up. From the late 19th century through to the mid-20th century, Latin America grew quite well. And Brazil was part of that. Argentina was the most successful Latin American country, but Brazil also grew. This stalled during the mid-20th century with a turn inwards and import substituting industrialisation policies. The recent growth path does look more sustainable. It's a more liberal institutional framework, and I think that looks more promising. The final case study of the BRIC countries is India, the original four countries. That's the poorest of the BRICs, at around about 10% of the US level. A lot of people worry about the institutional framework in India. There's a lot of talk of high levels of corruption. One thing I would like to point out, which gives a slightly more optimistic spin on the Indian performance, is that actually it's the only BRIC country where economic success has been driven more by services than by industry. And that, I think, bodes quite well for the future, because one of the key characteristics of rich countries is strong performance in service sector. As you get richer, the proportion of people's incomes that get spent on, first of all, agricultural products, you know, as you get richer, you want more food, but not that much more. Industrial goods then become more important. But ultimately, rich countries spend most of their income on services. And so you need good performance in the service sector. India actually exhibits that relatively early on. There's one final point that I'd like to make, which is to bring in the case of Africa. When the term BRICS was first coined, it had an S on the end, and some people like to think that applied to South Africa. And that's brought some sort of attention to the rapid growth that has been occurring in Africa over the last decade or so. And that's led some commentators to be quite optimistic about African economic performance. I think I would be a little bit cautious here, be somewhat sceptical about the sustainability of this current growth phase in Africa. We still see a lot of political instability and corruption in many countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And it's also the case that much of this boom has been based on exploitation of natural resources, something which history shows us to be often not sustainable. I will be more optimistic about African growth continuing if I see a downturn in the terms of trade and African growth continues. Then I think Africa will have a bright future to look forward to.